themselves less than 100 yards from the rear lines of the enemy infantry. Stike paused long enough to assess the situation and was surprised to find Car Pole riding up to him through the chaos they'd left of the Dionysus train.
"You need to get back with our reserves," he said. "Find Sunin and Selene. Stay with them."
Car Pole shook her head emphatically and showed him her slate. "Enemy, bone eye." Stike inhaled sharply. He was familiar enough with privilege to know when to show caution and when to charge. But he was not familiar with bone eyes beyond the ones in landfall who kept the Dynai's lines from breaking.
"Will it be dangerous to our men?"
Carpel shrugged and spread her arms. "I don't know." Stike ground his teeth.
"All right, change of plans. You're coming with me. Stay on horseback and stay close. We're going to kill the privilege first, then run down the bone eye."
He flipped his reins and raced to the edge of the hilltop, where the mad lancers had just finished spreading out into a line formation. The old lancers were on the left flank, led by Ibana, with the riflejacks on the centre and right. Gustav out on their wing. New recruits were mixed in equally. Stike rode past the old lancers and pointed.
"Gamble, Jackal, Craston, Felicia, bring your boys and follow me. We have a privilege to kill."
Stike took command of the centre, with about 2 dozen of the old lancers directly behind him, and Carpole at his side. Down on the floodplains, some of the Dionysus infantry had just noticed them, and were desperately trying to get the attention of their officers.
"Send them to the pit!" Stike roared. Amrak leapt forward. They galloped down the hill, flying over the soft grass and levelling out on the plain.
Mere seconds passed before he drew his carbine, fired off a shot, then exchanged the weapon for his lance. Carbine blasts went off all around him, and the Dionysus lines turned in a panic, attempting to fix their bayonets. They were too late. The tip of Stike's lance tore through a woman's shoulder as she tried to raise her musket, and her companion fell beneath Amrak's hooves a split second later. The sound of the line being trampled beneath iron-shod hooves made Stike's heart sing, and he dug his knees into Amrak's sides. They were through the rear lines in moments. Stike raised his lance, gesturing for the old lancers he'd set aside to follow him, as he slowed and cut sharply mere yards behind his own left flank. Amrak leapt the bodies of crushed Dionysus soldiers, and they swung out wide, beyond the lines of Dionysus infantry that began to organize as the charge faltered. Stike checked over his shoulder to see if Carpole was still with him, only to find her at his side. Her horse foamed at the mouth from the hard run, and her brow was furrowed with concentration.
"The trick to killing a privileged," Stike shouted to her, "is to take 'em by surprise. Privileged are just like any other fool. In the middle of the battle, they get tunnel vision. In a minute now, someone is going to turn him away from his bombardment and direct him at the lancers. Our goal is to reach him before..."
Stike's words were cut off by a sudden jet of flame shooting across the battlefield. It was startlingly close and heading toward the Mad Lancer line where Stike had been mere moments before. Dionysus and cavalry alike were consumed, and the air was filled with the screams of men and horses and the sickening smell of charred flesh.
"Before that happens,"
Stike finished, sawing hard on the reins and directing his small squad of lancers back into the chaotic lines of Dionysus soldiers. They ploughed the poor bastards down with the force of their charge, not even bothering to lower their lances. Stike caught the scent of brimstone on the wind and followed his nose. He soon saw the flash of white gloves among the teal uniforms and shiny breastplates.
"Lances!" he bellowed.
His small entourage sprang into a V formation, lances lowering. The privileged bodyguard was turned toward the main attack, and they didn't see Stike's flanking maneuver until the last moment. The sound of horses hitting soldiers was an audible crack, and Stike saw a gloved hand flash upward and wave toward him. His lance struck the privileged in the left eye and came out the back of his skull, tearing the entire side of his face off as Stike's momentum carried him onward. Stike whooped loudly, laughing as blood spattered across his stolen breastplate and Amrek's mane.
"Where is the bone eye?"
he shouted at Carpole. Carpole's horse suddenly leapt out in front of Amrek, and Stike found himself following her as she clung closely to her horse's neck, weaving the creature expertly through lines of confused soldiers. He could smell the copper of her sorcery, trying to differentiate it from the other bone eyes, but soon realized that he shouldn't have bothered. Still clinging closely to her horse, Carpole drew a machete with one hand and leaned down, letting her speed carry the blade into the back of a woman's neck. The woman spun, blood spurting, and fell to the ground with a cry. Carpole immediately jerked back on the reins, and Stike had to do the same to keep from ploughing into her. She leapt from her horse and straddled the woman, finishing the job with two blows from her machete. The Dainai soldiers, who until now had been confused but not disorganized, broke with a suddenness that shocked Stike. They began to run immediately, throwing down their weapons and fleeing. Stike drew his sword and laid about them until there was nothing else to swing at, then took a moment to breathe. Cleaning the blood from his face, he watched as the mad lancers crushed the Dainais against the river.
200 of ours dead, Ibana reported. Twice that many again, wounded. Stag nodded at the number, pleased.
He sat astride Amrek, flanked by Ibana and Gustar, while the lancers mopped up what remained of the Dainai's forces. As he'd expected, killing the privileged had been as simple as flanking the bodyguard. So few people were brave enough, or stupid enough, to charge directly at a privileged, that it was surprisingly easy to take them unaware. The bone eye, however, had been the breaking force. He remembered that particular sorcery from landfall, how the Dainais had been impossible to break until enough of their bone eyes had died. Their will had shattered with the same suddenness here.
"You know," he said to Ibana, "the Dainais at Windy River didn't break like this. They were tough bastards, even after Flint put them through the grinder."
"The army at Windy River didn't have a bone eye," Ibana said.
"Right. Logically, they should have broken faster, like these guys did when their bone eye died."
Ibana seemed to consider the conundrum.
"Maybe they're trained very well, naturally tough. A bone eye strengthens their will, but makes them brittle, so that when the bone eye dies, they're temporarily weak."
Stike turned to look at her, surprised by the observation.
"I've been given this thought since Windy River," Ibana admitted. "A few years back, I read a book on the effect sorcery has on the human mind. It was mostly incomprehensible rubbish, but I took away a few things."
"I'll be damned."
Ibana gave him one of her rare smiles.
"I mean," Stike continued, "I didn't know you could read."
Ibana leaned over and punched him hard in the shoulder. Gustav finished taking a report from one of his cuirassiers and turned toward them.
"A privileged, a bone eye, and an entire brigade shattered in exchange for a few hundred men? That's a damn fine trade, Colonel. Congratulations."
Gustav's riflejacks had taken the brunt of the privileged sorcery, but he too seemed very pleased with the results.
"I think the boys have earned a day off in Bellport."
"I don't disagree," Ibana said.
Stike eyed the gates of Bellport. They had opened moments before, and he'd spied a small force riding out to greet them under a Fatrastan flag.
"Strip the dead and wounded of supplies," he ordered. "Grab everything we can carry from the Dainai supply train. We'll camp here tonight, and give the men leave in the city in the morning. then move the next day.
In the meantime, Stike had personal business to attend to. Chapter 28 Mikkel sat on the floor of his room in the Merryweather Hotel in Upper Landfall. Since the occupation, the hotel had been taken over by mid-level Dainai's bureaucrats, unable to get a proper town home near the Capitol building. It was a posh place, far above his old pay grade, but he'd managed to use Yaret's name to secure a room there, and to take advantage of the fact that the hotel was well guarded and unlikely to be infiltrated by black hats attempting to take his head. The contents of Forgula's pocketbook were spread out in front of him. 7 Dainai's ration cards, a bundle of cigarette rolling papers, a number of Fatrastan and Dainai's coins, and a booklet filled with names and addresses on both sides of the ocean, as well as a calendar of appointments. It was the appointments that Mikkel had spent the last couple of days poring over. Everything in the book was written in Dainai's shorthand and a sort of minimal cipher, and it had taken him and Tenik together 2 afternoons just to establish a working translation. Mikkel stared at the calendar of appointments, reading over the last 3 weeks for the umpteenth time. He started from one point in time, the hour that Forgula met with Mahoosh in Claydon Park, and worked backward, trying to find a similarity between the 3 letters and 2 numbers she'd used to mark that appointment with any other appointment since the invasion. He was searching for a trail, evidence that Forgula had met with Mahoosh many times in the past or would again in the future. He finished his examination as the door to his room opened and Tenik slipped in.
"Anything on Mahoosh?" Mikkel asked, tossing the calendar of appointments on the floor.
"Nothing new," Tenik answered. "He's holed up in an old warehouse to the west of the industrial quarter. It seems he's been cautious since we raided his last hideout."
"Are we certain that he's staying put?"
"As certain as can be. One of our people saw his face less than 2 hours ago. He has people coming and going, but seems to have remained in one spot himself."
Mikkel snorted. "Damn fool.
If he really thinks we're onto him, he should be moving every chance he gets. Staying in one spot makes it easier to find him. Oh, I've been telling the Black Hats for years that everyone should have some espionage training."
"I take it they didn't listen.
They wouldn't even let me give our actual spies enough training."
Mikkel rubbed his eyes. They felt tired and bloodshot after spending so much time staring at paper. He needed to get up, go out onto the balcony, maybe even take a walk. He dismissed the notion. No time, and no need to put a target on himself. It had occurred to him last night just how much of a risk he'd taken by following Hendras himself. He should have pointed her out to some of Yaret's men and let them do the footwork. The more time he spent among the populace, the greater chance he had of being recognized, even with his dyed hair and new moustache.
"Tell our watchers to keep the distance. I don't want Mahoosh getting spooked. The sooner he moves, the more chance we have of following him directly to Jatura."
Stifling a yawn, Mikkel wondered if he shouldn't go spend the next few days watching Mahoosh's new safe house. He was, after all, the one who would recognize anyone else of importance. There was just too much work to do.
"Any progress there?"
Tenik asked, nodding at the calendar of appointments.
"Nothing,"
Mikkel responded. He picked up the book, tapping a pen against a bookmarked page.
"We have a shorthand here for the meeting with Mahoosh, and we figured out last night a system for marking names, places and dates. But I haven't found a single match for Mahoosh anywhere else in her calendar. She's either never met with him before,
or this was the only time she actually jotted the meeting down.
And if it's the former?
If it's the former, Mikkel tapped the pen against the page, then maybe our first guess was right. Perhaps Forgula is attempting to turn Mahoosh directly. She's not a traitor, or up to anything more insidious than recruiting an enemy. Which is exactly what we've been doing.
Tenik seemed doubtful.
Either way, Yarrett wants to know.
Well, that's fair.
Mikkel continued to tap away, considering his options. There might be something in this calendar that he missed. A hidden message jotted between the lines, invisible ink, even sorcery. But Forgula didn't have easy access to that kind of sorcery, and this was, after all, just a calendar. She wasn't high-ranking enough to think it would be lifted by a pickpocket. This was probably a dead end. He tossed the calendar aside and picked up Forgula's thin address book. This wasn't in shorthand or likely ciphered, not like the calendar. It was simply a list of contacts and addresses, just like any government aide might carry with them. He'd flipped through it twice now, and nothing had struck him as peculiar. But late last night, it had given him an idea.
"Do you have access to census records?" Mikkel asked.
"I do.
I need the records of all the bureaucrats and civilians who came over from Dionys."
Tenik's eyebrows furrowed.
"What do you need those for?"
Mikkel shook the address book over his head. "Because I want to compare her address book to the census records. If I can eliminate all the people who came with you from overseas, then I'll be able to tell who her local contacts are. From there, we can find out if any of them are known black hats, and we'll have a new trail to follow."
Tenik walked over to the window, pushing aside the curtain and looking out for a few moments before answering.
"Can't you differentiate between Fatrastan names and Dionys names?"
"In a pinch, yeah. But I don't know every Dionys name, and you don't know every Cressian, Fatrastan, or Palor name. I'm not going to look for every single name, just the ones I'm curious about. It'll be a couple of hours' work at most, and might save me a boatload of time in the future."
"Oh," Mikkel added silently, "I could just look for the latest entries in her address book."
But that wouldn't allow him to get his hands on the census data. He waited for Tenik to tell him he was being obtuse, watching carefully for an ounce of suspicion.
Tenik shrugged.
"If you wish. There is a single book that lists every civilian that came over with the army. I can get a copy to you within 30 minutes. I'm not sure it will be as helpful as you think, but I'll provide it."
"And someone to help me compare the names," Mikkel added,
hoping it would allay any suspicion.
"Of course."
Tenik headed to the door, but stopped suddenly and turned to Mikkel. Mikkel swallowed hard, waiting for a sudden accusation. But Tenik had something else on his mind.
"A warning to you, my friend."
"Huh?"
"Ictracia has been asked in about you. Your stunt with Forgula last night has piqued her interest."
Mikkel's throat began to feel tight.
"She doesn't have better things to do?"
"Most of the privileged are with the army," Tenik said with a shrug. "Ictracia remains with the government because of her grandfather's wishes. But there isn't a lot for a privilege to do in a new seat of government. Aside from the odd task that comes her way, she finds other diversions."
"And you're worried I might be a new diversion?"
"Just warning you that she's been asked in around, is all."
Tenik raised his eyebrows.
"However, I suppose everyone's been asking around about you. Before, you were a curiosity. Since you confronted Forgula, you've suddenly become very interesting."
Tenik left Mikkel alone with the contents of Fagula's pocketbook,
which he spent the next little while glancing through once more, before there was a knock on the door. A young woman arrived with the census data Mikhail requested. She was one of Yaret's household clerks, who'd picked up a little palo and adran, and they spent the rest of the evening comparing Fogula's address book with the census data. The work was tedious. They marked each person as either Dionys or Fatrastan, then went back through and double-checked all of the names. Only 13, all of them written in at the end of the address book, were Fatrastan, and most of those were readily recognizable sympathizers already helping the Dionys stabilize the government. Mikhail didn't much care about the information. It might be useful, but his real goal was to look through the census data himself. He scoured it whenever his assistant didn't need the book. He sorted through the tiny writing, poring over it like he might check the books of a crooked accountant, looking for any sign of this Mara, whom Taniel needed smuggled out of the city. After 4 hours, he bought himself some more time with the book by ordering his assistant to triple-check the list that they'd made. And at the end of the 5th hour, he gave the book to her and sent her back to the Yaret household. He stood by the hotel room window in frustration, watching as the evening guard did their rounds. He considered his path to this place, wondering at the idea that he was now working for a powerful Dionys minister, and he tried to imagine where Taniel and Carpole were now. He wished that Taniel was here. He had questions, questions he hadn't known he would need to ask. The first had to do with all the data he'd just scoured. Of the thousands of civilians who'd come over with the army to occupy Landfall, he couldn't find Mara. And not just THE Mara, but he couldn't even find A Mara. It was as if the name itself didn't even exist. Which forced him to wonder what the pit he was going to do if he couldn't even find this woman. Chapter 29 The Yellow Creek Jail was one of the few brick buildings in the city, positioned just behind the mayor's office at the end of a long street, that terminated 100 yards later at the base of one of the mountains. It was bigger than Vlora expected, with over 2 dozen holding cells guarded by a handful of deputies, all of whom kept a wary eye on Vlora as she was led down the hall to the last cell on the right. Unlike the other cells, this one had several small windows, with real glass instead of bars, and had a real bed and desk tucked into the corner. Taniel sat cross-legged on the bed, shoes off, jacket tossed over a chair, as if he were staying in a hotel room instead of a cell. His brow was furrowed as he drew in his sketchbook, and he didn't look up until the cell door was unlocked.
"Afternoon," he said cheerfully.
Vlora paused in the doorway, noting that the guard had left the two of them alone.
"Looks like you're living the high life in here." "It's a cell for important people," Taniel explained. "And you are?"
"A man with money."
Vlora took the chair and pursed her lips at Taniel.
"And you mocked me for paying for 2 rooms at the hotel." "Nobody's perfect."
Taniel flipped the page in his sketchbook, then lifted his chin, looking down his nose at her. She remembered that look.
"You're not drawing me," she said.
"Of course not," he replied as he began to sketch.
Vlora let it go.
"Do they know who you are?"
she asked quietly.
"They think my name is Tampo."
He paused to adjust the glove on his right hand, revealing a bit of red skin.
"And that?" Vlora asked, nodding at the hand. "One palo deputy knows who I am,"
She's a daughter of the Red Hand and knows the password, so I can trust her. But I haven't been able to get much more than the city gossip and good meals. Speaking of which, I heard you met with the other big boss. Why do they call him Brown Bear Bert?
Has a big bearskin on his desk. Claims he got a lucky shot off at an Iron Hook grizzly years ago and the name stuck.
And Bert? It's an Adran name.
No idea. Palo here call themselves anything they want.
How did you hear that, anyway? The gossip in this city is out of control.
Daniel glanced up at her with a frown, pausing before continuing his sketch.
Laura turned her face the other direction to annoy him. He didn't seem to mind.
There's 10,000 people crammed into a tiny valley in the middle of nowhere. Not much to do here besides poke your nose in other people's business.
Did you find it?
Laura shook her head.
I've checked two of the big valleys and a dozen of the little ones. Been at it all morning, too.
But there are a few things you need to know.
Oh, what's that?
There's another powder mage in Yellow Creek.
Daniel looked up sharply.
Oh?
A man named Noan. Claimed he was in the Starlish Cabal. Ever heard of him?
I haven't. Starlish, eh? They integrated their cabal, what, 4 years ago?
6, Vlora corrected. Privileged and powder mages, fighting side by side in a royal cabal.
Times change, Daniel shrugged.
You met him?
He came on to me last night.
And how did that go? Daniel asked with a smirk.
He's on Jesse's payroll, but he suggested that the three of us team up and slaughter the entire city and steal all the gold we can carry.
Enterprising?
He sure seemed to think so.
He didn't take my rejection well.
I'm guessing you did it with your usual grace.
I called him a coward.
Well done, Daniel said without a trace of sarcasm. Sounds like it was warranted.
It was.
But it means that we have a powder mage to look out for. I tried to make it clear I wasn't his enemy. But he took the, coward bit personally, and we beat the shit out of each other.
Daniel squinted at her over his sketchbook.
Oh, yeah? I didn't notice that shiner when you walked in.
So we have a rogue powder mage with a grudge, in addition to all his other shit.
He finally set down his charcoal and rubbed his eyes, leaning back in the cell bed. He let his gaze wander around his cell, his cool demeanor broken by a distasteful sneer.
This is incredibly inconvenient.
I would appreciate help.
I tried bribing the sheriff to see the judge earlier, Daniel said. No can do. And she made it very clear that the moment I'm out of this cell, we won't be welcome in this town any more.
Flora quelled a rising frustration.
Meaning I have to look for this thing on my own? And I only have until you get out?
Well, sounds like it, Daniel said with an apologetic smile.
You're the one with Carpole's damn compass in your head.
Little good it's done me. I spent a whole night looking for the artifact. All I can tell is that it's here. I don't know where, though.
One other thing. He hesitated.
The sheriff says there's a good chance they'll try to hang me. The local judge has been trying to crack down on violence.
Pit. Flora breathed.
She wasn't worried for Daniel's fate. She was worried that he would kill a whole lot of innocent people when they tried to carry out the sentence.
The ticking clock in the back of her head just got louder. All she could do was hurry.
She made a sour face, thinking back to the figure she recognized in the street last night.
What can you tell me about the Predi?
That got Daniel's attention. He closed his sketchbook and set it to one side, scooting to the edge of the bed.
"That's not a question I want to hear," he said intently. "I don't know anything about them, not any more than you. Powerful, privileged, that were responsible for summoning the gods to give order to the Nine, then responsible for the chaos that occurred once the gods left?"
"How powerful?" Vlora asked.
"Worth half a royal cabal on their own, is what Bo told me," Taniel answered.
He tilted his face to one side, watching Vlora cautiously.
"What aren't you telling me?"
"I saw Prime Lecter last night."
Taniel leaned on his fist, swaying to one side.
"No," he breathed. "We can't afford to have them involved with this, too."
"You're absolutely certain?"
"I recognized him in the street," Vlora said, suddenly feeling less sure of herself. "It wasn't until a couple of hours later that I realized where I recognized him from. I think it was him, but I won't be sure unless I see him again."
"And I'll bet my boots he'll recognize you if he sees you first."
Vlora swore under her breath. This damn city seemed to be getting smaller every day. First, the spat between the big bosses, then a powder mage, and now a mythical privileged older than her birth country.
"If it is him, it can't be a coincidence."
"He's here for the stone."
"Of course. What else could it be?" Vlora asked with a shrug. "An ancient sorcerer doesn't just happen to show up in the little frontier gold rush city where we're looking for an ancient artifact of great power."
Taniel looked like he swallowed a lemon. "We've got to find him." "Oh, shit, I wish Carpo were here. Prime Lecter might be more than even I can handle. I fought one of the Predi before and couldn't kill her."
He paused.
"Why would Prime Lecter want the stone?"
"Power?
He's an academic. Maybe he's trying to keep it out of Lindet's hands. Maybe he just wants to study it."
"That," Vlora said, "is too stupidly optimistic for me. We have to assume he's an enemy."
"Agreed.
Do I try to put a bullet in his head?"
"If that'll even work," Taniel snorted. "Pit."
"You could get out any time you like," Vlora pointed out.
"With violence," Taniel admitted. "But yes, the city will close to us the moment I leave this cell, either by force or judicial order. I'll cool my feet for the time being and see what kind of information my Palo friend can get me. I've got to be careful who I trust with the Red Hand information. I still have quite a bounty on my head."
"I'm going to look for Prime Lecter. If he's here, then he might already know where the Godstone is."
"Be careful," Taniel warned, raising his finger. "We don't know what he's capable of. One of those Predii carved through half of Tamas's powder cabal back during the coup."
Vlora remembered. Those people were her friends and comrades.
"She took them by surprise," she said, hoping there wasn't too much hubris in her bravado.
"I intend on taking him by surprise."
"And that powder mage?"
"Him too."
Taniel scowled, his expression uncertain. "I should get out of here."
"No," Vlora said. She could do this. She had to do this. Taniel's help would be ideal, but she still didn't fully trust his motives. If she could make this victory her own, it would be worth so much more.
"You can't attract attention. I'll find Prime and the stone by the time you're out of here."
She stood up. "But I need to use every minute to do it." Taniel took her hand, surprising her.
"Vlora," he said seriously, "don't get yourself killed. There's more going on here than we know. My Palo friend says that the Palo Nation has a presence here, but he doesn't know anything else. If we can contact them,
we might be able to get some help. Flora didn't know the first thing about getting in touch with agents of this Palo nation. I'm not exactly a welcome figure in the Palo community. They don't give a shit about the Southern Palo. They only care if you can help them. And can I help them? She really didn't like the sound of that. Maybe. Taniel seemed torn. I'll see what I can find out from here. Just be careful. Chapter 30 Stike was greeted by the mayor of Belltower as he entered the old city gates the day after the Mad Lancers relieved the city. The mayor was an older gentleman with the dark skin of a Deliv, distinguished in tails and hat, with spectacles perched on the end of his nose. He wore a red sash proclaiming his title, and he was on foot, surrounded by a small entourage of dignitaries dressed in their church-going best. As Stike rode through the gates, the mayor swept off his hat and bowed. There was a part of Stike that revelled in his fame, that enjoyed the women, booze and money his reputation had gotten him in his youth. But being thanked had always felt strained and awkward. He tipped his hat in return and gave a small wave to the dignitaries.
"You're Colonel Stike," the mayor said.
Stike glanced over his shoulder, hoping that Ibana would arrive with some kind of emergency that needed his attention. Carpole lurked on horseback a few dozen feet behind him. Other than her and Celine, there were only a few of his lancers riding in to see the city, and they slunk off quickly without making eye contact. The cowards. Stike lowered Celine to the ground and dismounted, handing her Amrek's reins. He shook the mayor's hand, hoping his discomfort was obvious enough that the group would bugger off.
"My name's Whitby," the mayor introduced himself. "Mayor Whitby. It's a pleasure to meet you, Colonel Stike, and I must immediately apologize that the city is in no shape to give you the reception you deserve."
He gestured to his entourage.
"These are all we could spare to come out and meet you. Everyone else is tending the wounded and putting out fires."
"No offense taken," Stike replied. "I'm not really one for receptions, to be honest."
The mayor charged ahead anyway.
"You arrived in the nick of time, Colonel. We sent for help weeks ago and only just received word that the Third Army was on its way to relieve us. But they won't be here for days and..."
His expression grew strained.
"Well, we wouldn't have lasted much longer. The bastards were lined up for a charge when you arrived."
Stike resisted the urge to reply with, "I noticed," and instead tried for a gracious smile, noting that Whitby had mentioned the Third Army.
"You charged a privileged," Whitby continued, "without any of your own, if I'm not mistaken. I've never seen anything like it."
"Privileged die like anyone else," Stike replied. "It's just a matter of getting close enough to put a lance through their eye."
The mayor tugged at his collar, his eyes fluttering as if he were unused to such bold discussion of violence. He stuttered for a moment, then said,
"I'm sorry you and your men camped out on the plain last night. I sent someone to invite you in, but they returned without an answer."
"I sent them away. We had bodies to strip and wounded to tend to. Look, Mayor, I appreciate you coming out to greet me, but it's clear that you've got a lot of problems to deal with. I'm going to be blunt with you. Everything that I've heard says that you're one of the only cities on the West Coast to survive the Dainai's landing."
Whitby took a shaky breath.
"I've heard similar reports. We've been discussing the possibility
of abandoning the city and sending the people inland.
With all due respect, that's a terrible idea, Stike said. The Dionysus are spread out, and Lindert's field armies are finally engaging the enemy. If the Third Army is already on their way, they'll need Belport as a foothold in Dionysus territory.
This is Dionysus territory now, isn't it?
Whitby asked, his expression fraught. Stike pointed at the ground at their feet.
This is not Dionysus territory. Not yet. And I suggest you not abandon it. You've got what, 100,000 souls in Belport?
About that, yes.
Comb the city for fighting men, engineers, and labour. Conscript everyone you have to. Rebuild your gun platforms, even if you've got nothing to put on them. The Third Army will have extras.
Stike racked his brain for more advice, trying to remember the very same conversations he'd had with politicians during the Fortrustan War for Independence. The situation had been remarkably similar, except the Dionysus had a lot more soldiers on the continent than the Kes did back then. He took the mayor by the elbow and pulled him aside, lowering his voice.
A word of warning. The field armies are stripping the countryside for everything they can get their hands on. Weapons, food, practical goods. If they arrive here and find Belport in chaos, they're going to steal everything you have to survive the winter and leave you to rot.
No, Whitby protested. The Lady Chancellor would never allow such a thing.
The Lady Chancellor is leaving that up to the discretion of her generals. And I know the General of the Third Army personally. He'll strip you of everything he can.
What can we do?
Organize the city. Rebuild those gun platforms, reinforce the walls and dig trenches. Get every craftsman in the city working toward the war effort, and when General Devori arrives, he'll see a useful war asset rather than dead weight for him to strip of resources. Whitby drew himself up.
I will do exactly as you say. I've served the good people of Belport faithfully for 8 years. I will rally them for all we have.
And don't let General Devori push you around. Tell him that Ben Stike is your friend and a city protector, and that I won't stand for any mistreatment of Fortrustan citizens.
Do you think it'll come to that?
Whitby asked incredulously.
I hope not, Stike chuckled inwardly. If it did come to that, it would piss off Devori something fierce. If he continues to press, tell him that Lindet herself has guaranteed the city's safety.
But she has done no such thing.
Consider me a mouthpiece of the Lady Chancellor herself, Stike lied.
He clapped the mayor on the shoulder and turned to the retinue, raising his voice so that everyone nearby could hear him.
The Mad Lancers came to resupply in Belport. We'll pay fair prices for what we need and won't take what you can't afford to spare. I'll allow my men a night's leave here before we move on tomorrow. If any of them refuse to pay for services or start fights, they will answer to me, personally.
He continued.
We lost about 200 men in that fight.
He jerked his thumb over his shoulder.
We'll lose more to wounds. Anyone with courage and the ability to ride is welcome to join us when we leave tomorrow. If you don't know how to fight, we'll teach you how. And if you're looking to punch the Dionysus in the teeth for what they've done to your families and homes, I guarantee you the chance.
He nodded to himself.
That's all. Thanks, Maya.
He returned to Amrec without another word, taking the reins from Selene and continuing on foot into the city. People stopped and stared as he passed by. He kept his head down and was left unmolested, but he could feel those eyes on his
shoulders. How did I do?
He asked Selene.
It was a good speech, she said,
nodding in approval.
I never got on with politicians. Don't have the patience or the knack for obedience.
Martell used to say that a politician is just a money-grabbing whore who won't stop to...
That's enough of that, Stike cut her off. One of these days you're going to run out of things, your da used to say. Celine tilted her head to one side and reached up, taking Stike's hand.
He did talk a lot.
Stike spotted the Lancers, who had abandoned him to the mayor, as well as Ibana. The lot stood outside a gunsmith's, talking among themselves.
For all their need for circumspection, I've never met a thief who could shut up.
Here. Stike gave the reins back to Celine and crossed the street. Ibana greeted him with a nod, smirking.
How's the mayor?
I think I put him off with talk of violence, Stike replied, but I prepped him for dealing with Devori.
Ibana's eyebrows rose.
Devori's coming here.
The mayor says the Third Army is a few days away.
You want to wait for them?
Ibana had a glint in her eye, and Stike suspected that if he didn't kill Devori fast enough for her, she'd do the job herself.
Stike shook his head. He's in command of a whole field army. I'm not bringing that down on our heads right now. There'll be plenty of time for gutting him when the fighting is done.
What's going on here?
Ibana gestured to the gunsmith. We've got everything we need except replacement carbines. We're seeing if anyone has stock in the city.
How bad is it?
We need 100. I'll settle for 25. Smiths don't normally make carbines without an order, so we'll have to scrounge.
Do what you can, Stike said, glancing over his shoulder.
Carpole was still shadowing him, waiting in the street astride her horse. Seeing her, he was struck by a tale from his childhood. A Palo legend that spoke of a woman on horseback who rode into battle behind those who were fated to die a violent death. He thought of the stories he'd been told of Carpole and God-killing. She would make a good angel of death.
Are you going somewhere? Ibana asked.
Stike pointed to a nearby barbershop window, filled to the brim with playbills announcing various shows, poetry readings, cockfights, and other bits of entertainment going on around the city. One of them said in bold letters,
Val Yain Soris, Fighter Extraordinaire.
Beneath the words was the address for a boxing arena, and a stylized printed portrait of a man Stike recognized well.
I'm gonna go put a knife in another old friend.
Chapter 31
There's been another bombing!
Mikhail tucked Fogula's address book beneath his menu and sat back in his chair in the café of the hotel lobby, as Tenik slipped into the chair across from him. Tenik wore a grave expression, and Mikhail could instantly tell that something was different about this one.
"Where?" he asked.
"The northern rim of Greenfire Depths. The bomb kills 7 local Palo leaders and the Minister of Rations."
Mikhail didn't know the name of the Minister of Rations, but he did know the title. It was the woman in charge of making sure that everyone got fed, from the army, to the occupying civilians, to the Fatrastan and Palo citizens of Landfall. When Mikhail had asked who the most important people in Landfall were, Tenik had listed her title among the top 10. And, based on what Mikhail had heard, she was good at her job. But that wasn't, Mikhail sensed, what was bothering Tenik.
She was an ally of Yaret, wasn't she?
A close ally, Tenik confirmed. Our households have been friends for 200 years. We were on the same side of the civil war. Shit. What's worse, her successor is her nephew. He's a capable young man, but he's back in Dionysus. The fourth in command of the household will have to step in, and she has never gotten along with Yaret.
Mikkel wondered how that would change the power dynamic. Clearly, it was on Tenek's mind as well, though Tenek obviously had a better grasp of what this would mean. The fact that he was so grave-faced didn't bode well.
"Does this have any effect on me?"
Mikkel asked bluntly. It wasn't a question with any tact, but he found that Tenek responded better to directness than to dancing around a topic.
"I don't think so,"
Tenek said. "If anything, it just makes it more important that we find and stop whoever is conducting these bombings. Rumour has it that Sevju will free up some of his own household to help with the search and give us more resources." Mikkel quelled his natural suspicion. If Sedil was offering a hand, it meant that this had gotten serious.
"No strings attached. The Minister of Rations was well-liked by everyone. Her household will continue her work under her cupbearer, but efficiency will be lost."
Tenek frowned.
"No one wants ministers to die. Not when we're in such a precarious position. Landfall is the hub of our invasion. Lindet has 3 field armies within 100 miles. Our own armies are more than a match, but to guarantee victory, everything in the city must go smoothly."
Mikkel wondered, not for the first time, if Lindet had secret communications with the Black Hats here. Everything seemed just a tad too coordinated for the workings of a single gold rose, and a skeleton crew of subordinates completely untrained for guerrilla warfare.
"We know it's Jatura," Mikkel said. "Knowing doesn't help us at all if we don't find him."
"Knowing will help us find him," Mikkel said with assurance.
In addition to trying to discover Forgula's connection to Mahush, he'd spent the last few days coordinating almost 100 people in a counter-espionage effort. Yaret's household had rooted out dozens of Black Hat safe houses, turned a small number of Black Hats, and imprisoned hundreds more. But the bombings only seemed to intensify. The only blessing, as Mikkel saw it, was that the occupied citizens wanted nothing to do with these bombings. Aside from a few radicals, most of the local leaders were decrying any violence that included civilians, and Jatura had made it very clear that he did not give a shit who his bombs killed.
"I have to go," Tenek said. "I'll be in touch, but you might not see me for a couple of days."
Mikkel hid his surprise. Despite giving him quite a lot of power to hunt down his former compatriots, Yaret had left Mikkel with a leash, namely Tenek, that had been present for most of his time with the Dionys. Tenek disappearing for a couple of days would be the most freedom Mikkel had had since before the invasion.
"What will you be doing?"
"Coordinating with the Interim Minister of Rations," Tenek said unhappily, "and trying to convince her that it's best for her household to remain close friends with the Minister of Scrolls. I have no doubt that at least one of Sedil's cupbearers will be attempting to convince her that a friendship with the Sedil household would be of more benefit. Forgula might even be there."
A woman dead by enemy hands, and the dogs just fighting over the scraps. It reminded Mikkel why he considered spying a more noble profession than politics.
"Anything I can do to help?"
"Find Jatura. Put an end to the bombings."
Tenek took his leave with those words, and Mikkel was once again alone at his little table in the hotel lobby. He glanced around at the few others in the lobby. He was the only non-Dionys in this hotel, and ever since he moved in, people openly stared at him as they walked past. Something he put up with just to get out of his room. From what Tenek told him, there were all sorts of rumours floating around. That Mikkel was a double agent who'd been working for Yaret for years, or that he was still a spy and taking advantage of Yaret's good nature, or even that he was half Dionysus, half Palo, descended from some banished nobleman. Mikkel did his best to ignore the rumours. Beyond punching Fugula in the face, he had little interest in Dionysus' politics. Results were what he needed. He considered Tenik's mention of Fugula before fetching her address book from beneath his menu and heading upstairs to his room, where he found her calendar sitting on his bed. He flipped through the calendar to today's date. It was full of meetings and tasks without a single moment of free time. Between her old schedule and this new disruption, Mikkel very much doubted that she'd be returning home any time today. There were all sorts of things Mikkel could do while Tenik was out of his hair, but he decided to do the most dangerous of them first. Fugula's personal address was in a small strip of workers' homes in the industrial quarter. Unlike most of the Dionysus bureaucracy, she had moved into an abandoned home in Lower Landfall, in a poorer area, where many of the buildings were still occupied by their Fatrastan owners. Mikkel scouted out the streets for a few moments, checking for anyone who seemed particularly curious about his presence. At this time of day, things were mostly quiet. A few old ladies hanging out the laundry in the street, a handful of children playing beside one of the industrial canals, but otherwise empty. The strip of homes where Fugula had chosen to live was a single building about 8 homes long, each of them 2 stories tall. The whitewashed exteriors turned grey from the soot from nearby factories. Mikkel had been an informant in this part of town years ago, and he was quite familiar with this sort of block housing. It was mostly occupied by factory foremen, lower-class workers who needed to be near their work and could afford a little more space for a large family. Mikkel walked up and down the street a few times before circling to the narrow alley behind the strip of houses. There was a gutter and a rubbish pile back there, reeking of shit and rotten food, but there was also a raised brick walkway that accessed the barred doors of each of the houses. The alley was abandoned, and Mikkel counted the back doors until he reached the address that coincided with the one written in the front of Forgula's address book. Standing on his tiptoes, he looked through the rear window. The place certainly seemed empty. Clearing his throat, he knocked loudly, waited 60 seconds, and knocked again. Nothing. He looked in both directions, stepped up to the iron barred door, and slipped a set of picklocks out of his pocket. It took him 3 minutes to get through the iron barred door, another 4 to get through the actual door beyond that. He stepped into a well-lit rear hallway, the floor creaking beneath his feet. "Fugula!" he called. There was no answer, so Mikkel began his search. He wasn't entirely sure what he was searching for, but that had often been the case when he'd done this in the past. The house itself was rather nicely furnished. The furniture was fairly new, it had quality wallpaper, and there were small luxuries scattered through the rooms, such as books, mirrors, and nicer clothing that was definitely for Traston in origin. Most likely it had belonged to the mistress of a mill owner, someone who could afford the nicer things in life, but wanted to stay near the factories. Furniture askew, clothing lying out, and the occasional bit of jewellery lying discarded on a table told the story of someone who'd packed hastily to flee town. Only 2 rooms had been tidied, the sitting room and one of the bedrooms upstairs, and these, Mikkel decided, was where Fugula was living. There were Dionysus books on the nightstand, and uniforms and extra clothes in the closet that looked about Fugula's size. There were several notepads, and it only took a moment to compare the writing on them with the writing in Fugula's address book to confirm their likeness. Once he'd done that, He checked each room with a steady, thoughtful eye. He looked for hidden nooks and crannies, disrupted dust, mismatched wallpaper, anything that would indicate a hiding spot for Fagula's valuables. He checked under shelves and sought gaps in the floorboards. Nothing seemed out of order. So he moved on to the more mundane. The bed, the wardrobe, and Fagula's sea